At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho, is the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and I got some good news. The Saturday Night Special is back this Saturday night, 9 p.m. EST on Facebook Live or on my YouTube channel. Just search Chris Jericho on either and you'll find the show. We're going to be shooting on the Stadium Stampede this week. Everyone's talking about one of the greatest matches I've ever been involved with, and I'll give you some behind-the-scenes stories solo, and we're going to do actually a whole Stadium Stampede podcast with the Inner Circle at some point as well. But this Saturday night, it's just me, so come have a drink, hang with me, and it's going to be amazing, talking all about Double or Nothing and the Stadium Stampede match we had all over the Jacksonville Jaguar Stadium. I'll be answering all your questions about it. We'll do a sing-along at the end. Facebook Live on my YouTube channel this Saturday night for the Saturday Night Special. We'll see you guys there. But today, Matt Cardona and Brian Myers, you know them better as Zack Ryder and Curt Hawkins, are here. They are longtime tag team partners and friends, even though they hated each other when they first met. You hear that story. And now the one thing they had in common eventually made them fast friends. They're talking about their early days at WWE, getting signed, meeting Vince McMahon, becoming tag partners, and working with The Undertaker. They're also talking about all the times they've been fired from WWE, including the most recent. And you'll hear all about their podcast, Major Figures, which was I was just recently on that. We had a great time. So both of these guys have been on Talk is Jericho before, but never together, which is unbelievable because you guys have been, of course, I'm talking about them, of the artists formerly known as Zack Ryder and Brian Myers and Curt Hawkins. It's, Matt Cardona and Brian Myers. It's going to be hard for me to call you Matt.
It's weird for me to call myself Matt.
Yeah, it is weird.
Is it weird after having those names for so long to know that now, like you said, you have to revert back to your original names?
See, for me, luckily we have this podcast where for 2 years I've been going by Matt Cardona. But before that, I like forgot that was my real name. Even my dad called me Zach, you know? So when it was time to, okay, well, I'm not going to be Zack Ryder anymore. Do I introduce another new name? Do I use my indie name? Like, forget it. Just Matt Cardona. Always ready, Matt Cardona. There you go.
What was your indie name before?
Oh, it was Brett Matthews, which was my backyard name.
With a Z.
With a Z. Of course.
Of course it was.
And how about you? What was your indie name, Brian?
So I had this weird thing. Like, I never fantasized about being anyone but Brian Myers when I was a kid. I never made up this other persona. I was like, no, I'm going to be the wrestler. Like, I don't think I, like, equated when I was little enough that these were fake names.
Right.
So I just never, like, I never changed it. And I guess kind of fortunately, the first time I got fired, I went out and, you know, became Brian Myers and already kind of semi-built that brand. And now between that and the podcast, it's actually, I would say more people refer to me as Brian than Kurt. Whereas I think, like, I don't think people even knew your name was Matt Cardona.
Exactly.
Until, like, a year and a half ago, yeah.
Well, you guys used to have gimmick names too when you first came in WWE, right?
Well, yeah, we were the Major Brothers, Brett and Brian Major. And then the story goes that Vince found out we weren't brothers, so we had to tell everyone our real names, which were, of course, Zack Ryder and Curt Hawkins.
It reminds me of there's a guy in Calgary. His name was Ken Smith, and he decided he needed a show business name for wrestling, so he changed it to Ken Johnson.
Oh, I like that. Wow. Real big departure there.
Mr. Charisma, right. Yeah. But so here you guys are after having a great run in the WWE, because especially for both you guys, I know you had two stints, Brian, and yours, Matt, was, gosh, 15 some odd years or something?
Almost 15, like 14 years. I got signed in the beginning of 2006 with Brian. We were 20 years old.
February 2006, 20 years old.
And you guys are like me. You grew up WWF fans, right?
Oh, 100%. Like the only thing.
Well, that would imply that we've grown up and we still don't like wrestling.
Oh, right. As you aged.
We're still just fanboys at heart, you know, and I think that's what's kept us half sane in this whole thing, you know, all these years.
Well, and you have to be. But to me, like you said, like starting in the WWE at 20, it took me, you know, I started wrestling at 19. It took me 10 years to get there at 29. And it was just, I couldn't believe how excited I was to be there. I mean, how was it for you guys growing up as wrestling fans and then starting so young in this company of your dreams?
Oh, I mean, I think it's something that, not that we took it for granted, we just thought this is the natural progression. You sign up to wrestling school, you have a WWE tryout, you make it to WWE, you know?
Right.
And it was...
Yeah, it all happened so fast that we just thought, like, oh, this is the way it is. And then we were just too young and dumb. You know, we're wrestling The Undertaker, like, literally every night of the week, you know, at 21 years old, and not, like... I want to say not understanding the full importance of it, you know, but I mean, trying our best and doing everything we can, but not understanding how fortunate we were to be there so fast, I think.
But how could you understand it? Like, right. I said, I mean, starting such a young age, I was talking to a couple bands yesterday that had gold records when they were 20 and just thought, well, that's how you do it. You start your band, you put a record out, you get a gold record. And then, of course, 2 years later, the band's broken up and there's nothing left. So to start at such a huge level, because you guys never... rode the van rides and sleeping six guys to a hotel and that sort of thing, or did you?
No, a couple indies in like the New York tri-state area, but like nothing crazy. We weren't indie
never,
darling.
We any, never had an overnight trip. We never had a plane ride until WWE. Like, no way, yeah.
How did? And first of all, I just realized that all three of us here are Long Islanders.
That's right, yeah. Baby.
Manhasset represent, yo.
Manhasset, yeah.
Merrick, baby.
I'm from Glencove. It's actually like very, very close to Manhasset, yeah.
And where are you from, Matt?
Merrick, where Brian lives now. He wanted to copy me, so he moved to my old hometown.
It's a very nice town.
So how did you guys get signed so quickly then?
Well, we started in the NYWC, and Mikey Whipwreck from ECW was the trainer there. And when we first started, we hated each other because we were the same age. We looked alike. We were the competition. I mean, I don't think either of us grew up wanting to be a tag team wrestler. You know what I'm saying? You dream of that singles run, you know? So we hated each other at first. And so many people said, like, you look like this guy. You should team with him. Ah, f*** this guy, you know? Like, I hated him. And then it was one day we realized we both were 18 years old collecting wrestling figures in hiding. They're like, oh, wow, maybe this guy's pretty cool.
That was the icebreaker. But, yeah, it was very competitive at first. And we kind of got just thrown together because we looked the same and we were the same age and same height or whatever. And the figures is what kind of broke the ice. And we were like, well, this is our shot to like actually be on the shows. I think we should just go with it and see where it takes us. And all these years later, we're still doing it.
You guys had a kindred spirit because you both were collecting the action figures. I mean, we could say toys, but it's so much more than that, as we know.
Right.
Action figures, the play sets, all of that sort of stuff. So you guys found this out when you first started out that you were both into it?
Yeah, a couple of months in. I forget how exactly we, because at the time we weren't proud about it. You know,
it was a little hidden dirty secret, man. It was in the closet. You didn't tell anybody about that. You're like, oh no. Especially at wrestling school, like I'm there with all these like, you know, indie guys, but I think they're like superstars to me, like megastars. You know, I don't know they're like mailmen and just regular people, but doing this too. You know, I just think like everyone who's a wrestler is a big deal to me. You know, that's how much of a fanboy I was. So things like that where I was embarrassed to say like, oh, I collect these wrestling figures, like no way am I saying that, you know, in this group of people and stuff. And then I don't know how it happened, to be honest with you, but then once the ice was broken, we'd go to like Toys R Us together, and that would be like a thing we do to hang out, you know, look for new figures and stuff.
Right, like I didn't tell anybody because I already had heat with those guys because they knew I was a backyard wrestler at Public Access. So they knew like that I was doing the wrong thing by not getting trained in wrestling. Obviously, I stopped doing the backyard stuff in high school, but they knew me for my persona that was on Public Access after Raw. So I already had heat going in.
You know, it reminds me of when I first started, when Bad News Allen was in the dressing room in Calgary. And, you know, I was 21, 19, 20, whatever. And Bad News Allen walks in, terrifying. And I remember there was some wrestling magazines lying around. And I think somehow I might have sent in my own picture to the magazine under a fake name and said, hey, you got to check out this Chris Jericho kid in Calgary. He's doing great. And the magazine actually printed the picture. And I remember somebody had the magazine and I was so excited about it. And Bad News said, he said, what are you looking at? I said, I'm looking at my pictures in the wrestling magazine. He said, really? He said, the only people that care about their pictures in wrestling magazines are marks and a slur for a gay person that I can't say right now. He goes, which one are you? I'm like, I can see that the same thing if you guys are in wrestling school and they're like, oh, they're playing with their little dolls.
Right, yeah.
Not be good for you.
We found that dynamic quite a lot on the roster, especially the WWE main roster, because we're, like we said, we're kids. And wrestling to us in our age group, you know, our generation was romanticized with, you know, bed sheets and toys and video games. And we just grew up very different than just maybe a, you know, a black and white PWI is like, what is that it? You know, that's all you really have to romance this obsession. You know, so we're sitting there and, you know, changing next to Bob Holly and The Undertaker like, oh, okay. We're a little different. And we knew that. So we knew to keep our mouths shut. But that was definitely something that differentiated us.
Yeah, because we were just young kids. And it was a totally different vibe, totally different locker room. Like, you couldn't just, we debuted and we're still changing the extra talent until we asked for permission. You know, it's totally different atmosphere now, you know. So there's no way I was going up to Taker and be like, what up, dude? I just collected your new fig, you know.
Yeah.
So you guys are, you're in the small school and you're tagging up now. So how does that lead to you getting into WWE?
The main thing that I remember is we were just starting to get our feet wet. I think right away, I think we stood out because we got gear and we matched. And like, you could see we were trying. Maybe we weren't all that talented yet, but we were trying. And Mikey Whipwreck, our trainer, brought in Tommy Dreamer when he was the, I guess, kind of the head of talent relations. I don't know what the official name was. And we did a 6-man tag with him. And I think that's how everything really got rolling, is we were on Tommy's radar after that.
Yeah. And then there was a WWE.com tryout where you signed up for this application. And then, you know, of course, we signed up and we got accepted to the tryout. And we did so bad at this tryout. Like, I wish there was footage. Like, it was horrible. But
there's got to be footage somewhere because it was recorded. So,
like, I remember the first thing that was after everyone got in the ring and rolled around and wrestled around, you would go in front of a camera. And I took it as talk about your favorite wrestler and like why you want to be in the business. So like Brian and I were so excited to be first. So we went up first. And I think I said like, my favorite wrestler is Edge and blah, blah, blah. I'd like to wrestle him because he grew up watching wrestling and so did I. And then Brian did something. And then everyone after us cut into promos, like cutting a promo on The Rock. Or cutting a promo on Jericho. We're like, holy shit, what did we just do?
So that was at the Nassau Coliseum during the day before a live event. So it's not even like the big cool stage is there. It's just very, the whole thing was very depressing, I guess I'd say. And then I remember Dreamers kind of sat us all down as a group after and was like, that was not a very good tryout. Like, I don't know what's going to come of this for like anybody. So we kind of chalked it up as like, oh, okay, I guess that was an okay experience. He gave us free tickets to the live event. I remember we sat there and watched the live event. And then we were like, all right, back at it. And then he called us that week. I just couldn't believe it.
With the idea to pair you up with Edge, or he just liked the look of you guys as a young kind of hot young upstart tag team?
He was sending us to Deep South Wrestling in McDonough, Georgia under Bill DeMott.
Oh.
So we did that for a full year until our call up.
So that's kind of, you know, paying the dues, shall you say. You mentioned you didn't really travel in the vans or anything like that, but I'm sure Deep South was not exactly very glitzy and glamoury.
Oh, baby.
Chris, let's just say this. I can't wait for you to narrate Dark Side of the Ring, Deep South Wrestling. It's coming. I think Luke Gallows and I will make sure it comes and comes soon because the story needs to be told. That place was, looking back on it, insane. Looking back on it, some of the best times of my life, but wild, wild shit went down there. And as far as paying our dues, I would say if you went through Deep South, your dues were paid in full because you bumped enough for 7 careers in 1 week.
Tell me what you would have to do in Deep South Wrestling. What's a typical week looking like?
Well, Matthew here had night terrors thinking about it, waking up each day. He couldn't even sleep, so maybe he can get into it a little bit.
I mean, I did. but at the same time, we were so young and dumb. I just thought, okay, this is WWE. This is what it's like. And it was just so hard. And yes, the practices were hard and stuff like that. But you know what? Like, it made us all tougher. And I would do it again because it made us who we are. And yeah. the friendships and the bonds that we formed with those guys, you know, we still have those to this day. So looking back, yes, okay, at the time, was I having nightmares about it? Yes. But would I do it again? In a heartbeat, because I love it. I love that time of my life. And I truly believe I wouldn't have the mental toughness, wouldn't have anything if it wasn't for Deep South and Bill.
Deep South and Bill, like, fully toughened my thick skin for this business where, you know, no rib or no online review or anything. It's all just like, oh, off. Like, it, you know, it really helped me in my career in that sense, for sure.
That's where you lost the innocence of wrestling just being this magical thing and actually getting into the business.
I'll never forget it. One of my, like, first weeks in training back in Long Island, a guy was on the apron with me and he goes, man, you're a fan of the business? I was like, yeah, I love wrestling. He's like, it's never going to be the same again. I'm telling you right now, no matter if you just wrestle in these armories or you go on to superstardom, like the innocent way you've seen wrestling, it's over. And it's just something you have to accept if you're willing to get into it like that.
I remember the first time, the first real wrestling experience I had was my dad knew a promoter in Winnipeg. His name was Bob Holiday and he was running a tour. So they brought me on to be on the ring crew. And over that 2 or 3 weeks of touring, you know, Manitoban Indian reservations, I learned what the business really was. And I'll never forget the time this guy, he was the only nice guy on the tour that wasn't treating me like a total mark, which is what I was. His name was Catfish Charlie. Nice. And when he explained to me that when you win a title, you don't really win a title, I remember I was just crushed. I couldn't believe it. Like, what? Like Hogan really didn't win? Like, that's real, right? Like, I understand the matches are predetermined, but that's real. And he's like, no, even that's not real. No. And it took me a good 3 or 4 days to really wrap my head around that because there was no internet at that point. But like you said, that was my transition from the magic and mystique of the business to being like, this is hard, you know, hit the road type of a job.
Yeah. And like, I grew up watching wrestling and I thought I knew everything. I even, like I said, I backyard wrestled. I thought I knew everything. But once I got into it, like, shine, what's a shine? What's a heat? What's a comeback? It like blew my mind.
I'll never forget. One day we walked in and Mikey had it on like a dry erase board, I think.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We couldn't get in the ring and it was like shine, heat, comeback. And I was like mind blown. Like,
what is this?
What on earth? Every match?
Who else was it with you in Deep South?
Oh, man. Gallows.
Gallows, who's still one of our best friends this day. MVP.
Oh, wow.
Angel
the Great
Williams.
Kali.
The Great Kali, which was hell on earth. You'd have to get called back after a 5-hour practice for Kali practice where he just drill you in the head with that chop and slam you and kick you. And
let me just say, that chop felt like a damn tree branch falling.
100%.
That was not worked at all.
Our first Deep South like event, we had a live event at Six Flags, and me, Zach here, and Kenny Omega actually were the noobs.
Oh, Kenny,
and
we were all dressed. The noobs?
Yeah. Yeah, we were all the brand new guys there, and we were fake security guards, and it was Kali or somebody, maybe Gallows, and it was ended in like a schmoz, and we had to run in as security and all take the Kali chop, and I was, you know, I'm so excited. This is basically my first like WWE thing I'm doing, and that I could not believe how hard that, it was like getting hit with a cinder block over the head, like, whoa, you know.
A very slow cinder block.
Oh.
What?
Who else? But Vladimir Kozlov.
I remember him.
Slam Master J, Ray Gordy is one of my favorites, actually.
The good old Ray.
Yeah.
I haven't seen him in years. So what finally led for you guys to get to the main roster then from Deep South?
Oh, that's another weird story. So Deep South got shut down, and they were going to move everybody to this new FCW. It hadn't even started yet. But a few of us were going to go to OVW. I believe it was us and maybe like
Jesse
Brad
and Festus.
J and Jesse and Festus. And then in that week of moving from Atlanta to Louisville, we got the call to just show up at a SmackDown ECW taping. And all of a sudden, there we are, debuting on ECW as the Major Brothers. It just like happened out of the blue. And then we had to go to OVW and be at OVW for the other 6 months. It was so weird.
It was like 8 months. We had to do both. So we were on the road full time and then we were in OVW full time, like basically no days off.
Is that they just needed bodies on the show and they were trying to build new characters for ECW?
Yeah, I think that the pitch was that they were going to eventually make like a tag team division that never happened. So that's how we kind of got lost in the shuffle. And then we got drafted to SmackDown and then really did nothing on SmackDown until the whole Edgehead thing happened in December of that year.
Yeah.
How did that start? Because I mean, obviously you guys kind of all looked a little bit like little junior Edges. And Edgehead is such an Adam thing. I'm sure he came up with that.
No, so this actually didn't at all. And we barely knew him at this point. So like you said, we kind of got set up almost for failure looking back on it. Like there was supposed to be some kind of division on ECW of tag teams, never happened. And we were just green babyface tag team doing nothing. Back then in developmental, there would be these days where the writers would come down and you'd kind of have to put on like a fake performance for them. You have like these matches and the crowd is them of 10 just watching you. You know, you do full entrance, a promo, same with your opponents. And then you have a 6-minute match or whatever. So we were at TV. Like I said, we were full-time OVW and live, you know, TVs and live events. And we see Michael Hayes and we're like, hey, you guys are coming this week, but like, we're already on the road here. Like, what should we do? He was like, well, show me something different, okay? And we were just like, and we kind of took that as like, all right, fuck you. Like, and we conjured up this thing. We were watching a lot of Entourage at the time. So we kind of stole it from Entourage where we wanted to be, since we looked like him anyway, and we truly admired him and marked out for him anyway. We were like, what if we were Edge's Entourage and we were like his, you know, his lackeys and blah, blah, blah. So we raided the merch drawer of all the Edge stuff. And that week we came out to the music at the promo. And I think unexpected to everybody of all those writers that came, and that really got all the wheels spinning. And then back to friggin' Michael Hayes. So he was like impressed with it all. And he's like, well, you can't just be with Edge. I need like a storyline or something. Like, so then we had to like, so we were like, okay, that. And then we had to sit back and conjure up this plan of like how we can be with Edge.
There's a Michael Hayes told me once, just because everyone's chanting your name, don't think you're over.
Right.
I'm like, isn't that kind of the definition of
yes.
So when this was pitched to Edge, was he obviously he had to agree to it to
yeah, there was a pay-per-view coming up where Edge would be in a triple threat match against Batista and Undertaker for the title. And then we had this idea like, well, what if we're like under the ring and one of us comes up as Edge and like Batista takes one out and then like another one comes up and Taker takes him out thinking it's Edge. And then Edge finally reveals himself and wins. And I think
it's kind of like, what the fuck? Who are all these Edges? Yeah.
And then Brian, I think you got his email address.
So like we literally, we know him in a hello and goodbye
right.
relationship right now. Maybe a conversation once or twice. I mean, that is it. And literally went up to him. I said, hi, sir, Mr. Copeland. I said, my partner and I have this idea. Would you mind if I, and he gave me his email and I wrote like a very concise like email. And he, luckily, like the graces of the wrestling gods, he actually read it, which I can't believe, and liked it mm-hmm. enough to talk to Michael. And then I remember before we did the real, I don't even know if Matt remembers this, the real like deciding factor was like if we really looked like him. So he brought a bunch of extra gear and we kind of like hid in an office at a TV and tried it all on. And we were waiting for Michael to come and see it. And I remember like Funaki saw us by accident. He goes, oh, you guys. And I was like, okay, I think we're good. If Funaki digs it, you know, or he's believing it.
Yeah, if Funaki likes it, we're done. We're good.
Yeah, we're good, man.
We're good. But I mean, as a heel, he's smart enough to know that it's always great to have, you know, not minions, lackeys, you know, whatever they are, guys that can kind of go out there and you know, cause distractions to win and then take the heat afterwards. And that it actually was a great, because that was the start of that classic Edge versus Undertaker storyline. You guys were right in the middle of it, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, luckily we went from absolutely doing nothing, you know, like sitting on catering at SmackDown to the next week wrestling Ric Flair, Shawn Michaels, Undertaker,
Every night, learning experience,
yeah. Unbelievable, you know?
How was it for you guys to work with those guys?
For the most part, I mean, first off, I always say this, we got to watch Edge be a world champion in the biggest company in the world, you know, night in, night out, see what he does, like in the main event every night, sitting there basically in the best seat in the house, you know,
right.
Learning from him, which is like invaluable. But besides that, even on the regular shows, especially the live events, we were always like the match before intermission with Fit Finley and insert partner going like 20, 25 minutes
wow.
in these like shoot tag matches with Fit, which like excelled our learning as pro wrestlers faster than I think is humanly possible. And we owe him so much for that. You know, it was just like invaluable learning experiences across the board.
But see, that was no coincidence. They put you in that position for a reason. So you would learn and become, if you guys are in the main event spot, you better have the timing and poise to be involved in that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the stuff that we were doing with Fit, it was whatever Fit wants to do, we're doing it. There was no calling it in the back.
That's great.
If Fit wants to fight us, we'll fight. If he wants to fight back, we'll fight back. We were just not even listening, but just reacting, you know?
Yes.
And that's what we had to do. And we thank him so much for that.
The true art of wrestling, not thinking about the next spot, but living in the moment.
Exactly.
That's something that every veteran, I remember Raven taught me that years ago. It's like you got to stop thinking about what's next and just worry and relate and react to what's going on right this the second.
And that's totally what it was with him.
So tell us some of the highlights of this angle with Undertaker. Because I vaguely remember you guys taking choke slams to the floor, or maybe you're on top of a Hell in a Cell, or I can't remember. There's a lot of stuff going on with you guys, though.
It was like 10 months of every SmackDown and every pay-per-view at least, right?
Yeah.
Main event of WrestleMania running down the ramp, taking choke slams
and
Taker.
And talk about how naive and young we were. So our first WrestleMania, we run in the main event. So I'm thinking, all right, so next year at WrestleMania, it'll be me versus Hawkins versus Edge, triple threat. Yeah. But instead, we're in the lumberjack match in the kickoff, you know?
It did feel very like this is never going to end kind of thing, right, for sure. And I think that happens. This happened to me a few
but
times.
I think, you know, that's what needed to happen. We needed to be like, okay, we needed a little like, okay, hey, a little slap in the face with reality.
Yeah.
But like you said, that's when you learn at 20 years old that most people don't get this opportunity, right, at this stage. It takes years and years and years. So it was good for you guys to learn that lesson, because a lot of guys don't learn that lesson and they're gone the next 6 months.
Right.
You know, we've seen that happen before.
That old WWE mentality of like, there was like no strikes, man. So, you know, sometimes you messed up and you're just gone. Like there was no.
Explain that. No mistakes allowed.
Yeah. Now I feel like you can make 15 mistakes and still sit home and get paid. But back then, man, whew, the littlest slip up, it's like, okay, where'd so-and-so go? He's gone. Wow.
Did you guys ever get any talkings to by Undertaker, for example, for not doing the right thing?
He was actually pretty cool and very,
like, I remember I worked him once on SmackDown, like singles, like, and I was so nervous and he was asking me like what I wanted to do. And it was like unbelievable. And he took the time afterwards to sit me down and explain, okay, you did this wrong, you did this right. And he did that with us a lot.
He was pretty giving. Like, I know a lot of times we would do this, walk the top rope spot. And he would let us like counter it where he'd like roll through. And I was like, man, it's the legendary Undertaker. He's letting like Jabron Edgehead like stop him from doing his signature thing to get to something else. I just always thought that was so crazy. And then even like the spot we did at WrestleMania, like he's like, what do you guys want to do? I remember we kind of like constructed that and ran it by him. And of course he okayed it. But
what was the spot? What did you guys do?
I'm trying to think. Edge is getting beat up. We run down. We pop up. But bumps one of us, maybe me, to the floor, yeah. And then he goozles you, and then the choke slams on top. Like, we came up with the whole thing. Like, basically, it was like, here's your chance to be involved, now come up with it. So, and yeah, I guess
he choke slammed one guy out of the ring on top.
Yeah, almost like it becomes like a dive where I catch Broski, yeah.
My biggest fear is that we were going to get, like, sacrificed on the cross the weeks before in Miss Mania. You know what I'm saying?
And that could happen too, man.
100%.
You know that could happen. It could happen. They could change it during the show. You never know.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
So what was the end of the Edgeheads characters?
So what happened was Edge just got hurt. And then without Edge, we were just the Edge guys. Mm-hmm. You know, we were Hawkins and Ryder, but nobody knew who was who, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we won the tag team championships and we were Hawkins and Ryder. And then we lost them. And then it was just like, what are you now besides, like, you know, the... good hand tag team, you know. Yeah. that's basically what it became.
So where did you go from there then? I don't remember this.
So the brutal part about it is they said they were going to split us up and then like didn't. Like every week we'd show up and be like, oh, and then we were just doing jobs, but we were always on. Mm-hmm. And then there was a draft and we finally really got split up.
Well, I mean, that's when I knew like, okay, this is my chance to, I need to change the look completely from Edge Hawkins. I needed to cut the hair. That's when the whole woo 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 broski thing started. And we had kind of been pitching that as a team where I would be that guy and he'd kind of be like the you know, the straight laced guy. And then they just wanted it me by myself. And luckily I was able to take off with that. And then he had to go back to FCW and rebuild himself. So like, again, it's a rebuilding phase.
Broski got drafted to ECW and I got maybe stayed on SmackDown. And then I didn't have an idea. I really had no clue what I wanted to be or what Curt Hawkins was going to become if he wasn't a tag wrestler. And I stopped getting travel. And I had been around long enough to go like, that is like, that's a sign of death around here. So after like maybe 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, I called Johnny Ace and I said, look, I'm not getting travel. I know what that means. Like, I'm not going to sit home, get fired and get my emails ignored. You know, I can't do anything from my couch. I was like, I'll just go to FCW if you want me to. I'll outwork every guy you got down there and prove myself and get back up. And he's like, okay, but I'm not paying you because I'm not sending you. That's your choice. So I went to FCW unpaid for a year and did every practice, every show, everything imaginable to get back to the main roster.
Unpaid?
Yeah, unpaid.
No kidding. Wow. Mm-hmm. I've never heard that before. So they allowed you to work for them, not under contract?
I was under contract still, but I wasn't owed any money. I got my video game check that month, and that was my full shitty little downside, and that was it.
They don't know me any money. $7,000 a year downside.
And Johnny was making it clear, like, we're not sending you there. Like, we don't think you suck and need more work. This is your choice. So, like, I'm not going to pay you for that. I said, all right.
Wow.
Yeah. So I bet on myself, and it paid off. But
how did you make a living? Like, how did you make ends meet?
I had to just live off the. I mean, I'm 23, single. I lived with Trent Beretta in a shitty little apartment, and, you know, partied with him and Fandango and made it work.
So that's amazing. Think about what you just said. 23, and you're down doing this, and that's what we were talking about earlier. Just how quickly it goes by.
Oh yeah.
Coming in main event WrestleMania, then you got to go to FCW for a year to work for free. Now, for you, Broski, this became a pretty big deal because you got yourself over in a lot of ways. And we discussed this before, but it was years ago. And actually almost got heat because you grabbed the brass ring. How dare you? Yeah. And got yourself right. Over.
Yeah. So, like, on ECW, it was great because, you know, it was the 1 hour show. It was kind of like the Misfits show. And I was, you know, you hear the expression like a big fish in a small pond. And that was great. So I was on every week. I was getting to wrestle Christian. Learning, you know, and getting to cut promos and show my personality and stuff like that. But then once ECW went away and I got moved to Raw, it was like, oh shit, because now, now I'm like just a nobody. And now I'm still trying to get noticed. And I remember there was so many guys helped me out. I remember you pulled me aside and said, like, get rid of the one-legged tights. You know, it was a lot of people.
Griffith Joiner tights, yeah.
A lot of people helped me out, but still, like, I was just so frustrated doing nothing, and I knew that I could do so much more. And that Christmas, my parents had gotten me, this is so old, a flip camera, and I didn't know what to do with them. Like, what am I going to do with this flip camera? Like, thanks, Mom and Dad. What the hell am I going to do with this? And I'm like, well, what if I did, like, some sort of, like, skit, like, web show thing on YouTube, and, you know, I'll edit myself and try to show my personality that way. And little did I know that it would snowball and turn into something that I never expected and way bigger than, you know, I would have ever imagined. I really believe, like, that's why I'm here talking to you now, is because of that show. Mm-hmm. Because, like, that's what I think built my career, was me building myself and the audience saying, you know what, like, fuck it, let's help this guy out. And them supporting me and chanting my name at shows I wasn't even at, and buying my merch. And at this time, I'm still not even on TV. Like, I'm on maybe once a week doing something, like losing to somebody, or I'm on Superstars, or whatever that show was at the time. But it was just the skits I was doing. It was just causing like a snowball effect. And, you know, I was trying to get, like, buzz. I was trying to create some sort of buzz. Whether I got noticed by WWE and on TV, great. But if I got fired, I'd have a buzz and I could go somewhere else, like at the indies, and have a name. And I just wanted some buzz. I didn't just want to be a guy collecting the paycheck. I didn't want to show up and eat the shitty salt and pepper chicken and catering. I wanted to do something. You know what I'm saying?
Of course. And it's funny too, because that was the precursor to being the Elite. And even the thing we're doing now, the Bubbly Bunch, of just kind of homemade filmmaking with a sense of humor to it. And I think that you were the first guy to do that before anybody else.
I definitely was not the first person to have a web show. No way. But I think I was the first person to realize, like, hey, like, I can connect my character on TV to my personality at home and do this myself. And it definitely worked, because, like, at the time we were so young. So I was on Twitter, I was on YouTube, I was on Facebook organically. So instead of, like, Matt Cardona doing it, I was doing it as Zack Ryder, this, you know. And then people like, I like this guy, I'm just like him, or I like this guy, I want to support him. Or the funny things, like, you know, instead of complaining and bitching and moaning, I'd be climbing a fence and somebody would be like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm trying to get over. Just stuff like that. And it's like, well, how can we really hate on this guy? You know, like, he's just trying.
And I was just going to bring that up. I remember that. Like, they say I can't draw money, and you're drawing, you know, $1
literally drawing
bill.
Money. Yeah.
And that's my point. Like, that being the Elite really took kind of the insider talk to the masses. But you did that before anybody else did. So how was that received? Obviously, the fans got over it, because I know, I remember one time it was even The Rock was in the ring, maybe in Long Island, and they were chanting.
Dude, that was the best.
Ryder,
that's
Rock
the Garden.
That's the Garden, yeah.
The Garden?
Yeah.
I want Broski to tell a story about this that I don't think he wants to tell, but I want him to tell it.
All right, tell it, baby.
Okay. So let me just tell my part of this. So I got called by Johnny Ace leading up to this show. This is The Rock's big return at Madison Square Garden. He does that tag match. Johnny Ace calls me. I thought I was getting fired, but he's like, oh, we want you to be like Rock's personal like punching bag, basically. Whenever they built the ring, wherever he was filming a movie, and I would fly in like 7 a.m. flight and a 7 p.m. flight out of Miami, wherever we were. And I would be like his punching bag, you know, buddy. Like me and Joe Hennig would be like the guys that he'd roll around with. So I was doing that. And then I was at that show. I don't know why, but I had to be there. So it was at the Garden. And he's not booked, right? You're just doing a run-in.
Right, I'm not booked.
And the crowd is going insane for him. Like I've never seen before, like at a live show like this. Like it's the coolest thing ever. And I'm like swelling with pride. So finally, it's Miz, Ziggler and Morrison.
Yes.
And you do the run-in on that match.
Right. So this is November. I start the YouTube show in February. So it's almost a whole year of working my f-ing ass off and just getting trying noticed. To get noticed. Yeah. Trying.
From like, pure jabroni status like, to like, the literally. Madison Square Garden shaking for this guy.
Right.
Shaking. Like it was so cool to see.
It literally took almost a whole year. And it was the fall time where I think eventually they said, look, we got to shut these people up. Because like I wasn't even like booked at these shows and they're chanting and they're bringing these signs. And then I was incorporating that into my show. I had somebody who would literally watch Raw and SmackDown and find a Zack Ryder sign and screenshot it. And then I'd include all those signs in my YouTube show and it would entice people to bring signs, mm-hmm. you know? So I was just trying to create as much momentum as possible. Finally, I think they had to just put me on to shut everybody up. But now the chants were getting louder and louder, and especially the match he's talking about, it was a Ziggler versus Morrison match. Like, listen, like I don't want to toot my own horn, but holy shit, like I'm getting goosebumps just thinking about like Madison cool Square Garden. Shit, like not only is it our home arena, but it's the f-ing Garden, you know?
Right.
And like I go out there and I, you know, the place is going nuts, and I get through the curtain and like Triple H is like, come here, and I'm thinking like, finally, this is it. He's gonna say like, good job, kid. Like I'm like, this is what I've been waiting for. Like, how can you deny this? It's Madison Square Garden, right? And he pulls me aside, and I had just like got like a fresh like blonde tips in my hair like that week. So he asked me like, why'd you dye your hair? And I'm like, what?
What?
Like that's this? I'm Madison Square Garden chanting my name. You're asking me why I dyed my hair first? I've been dyeing my hair for months. It just was like a fresh job, like you know.
Yeah.
I'm like, come on, man. Like I thought, like he put give me the old come here. I'm like, yes, he's finally gonna say, like, good job, man. Like, all right, we believe on you. Let's go. But it was like, you can't go dyeing your hair like that or something like that. I was like, oh, yeah, man. Like
you gotta ask the office before you make changes to your look or whatever. Like,
and that's all that was said?
That's all that was said that night, yeah.
So that tells me that you probably then for some reason that created heat for you, the fact that you got yourself over.
Listen, I can't say that. I can't say no, but.
Okay, I'll speak on your behalf because I'm so proud of you in this whole era of your career. And the things, honestly, like the groundbreaking kind of things you've done for the wrestling industry in a sense. But, and Chris can attest to this, every year, as long as I was in WWE, after the Raw after Mania, we have this BS company, everyone there at TV meeting where we say, the brass ring is there, it's yours, it's a fresh year, who's going to get it? Ever since Long Island Ice Z and the whole Z True Long Island story thing, they don't even bother with that meeting anymore.
Wow.
Because they know it's not true. It's not true, because even if you grab the brass ring, you're going to get your hand smacked and... If they don't want you to have it, you're not going
to
have it.
And once again, you guys don't have to contribute to this if you don't feel it. But there really is a little bit of a strange resentment. If Vince doesn't think of it, it's not valid. It's not real. And the same thing happened with Daniel Bryan when he first came in. I mean, Vince did not like him because he was a vegan and all these other reasons.
Yeah,
and
same.
The guy went and got over because he knows how to get over. And they still resisted it for so long until finally they had no other choice. I feel the same thing happened with Zack Ryder, and that you got over so well, you gave yourself an internet title, you know, all that.
I'm
other
still
stuff.
The champion, by the way, Chris.
I think he lost to Primo in a live event. I don't know why he always says that.
No, I defended that. This is another true story. I brought the title out once at a live event in Australia against Primo, and I beat him, and I filmed it for my YouTube show, and like Mike Rotunda was so pissed afterwards that I brought out the belt.
Well, I'm sure that made the report right after
that. But I still have the footage. It's a great match. Hell of a match.
Hey, dude, listen, now you guys can have a rematch. It's what the world is waiting for. You're going to get straight to Australia and made it happen again. But so all of this stuff is going on for you, Zach, and for you, Brian. You mentioned you're in FCW for a year. How did you finally get back up to the main roster? Because I know you said already that you got fired another time before this recent change. So did you come back to the main roster from FCW before you got let go the first time?
Yeah, so I did Let's think about this. Okay, in May 2009, I went to FCW. May 2010, I got recalled up with in a tag team with Lance Archer.
Oh, wow.
Actually. And we were like rocking and rolling and like running in and like taking out top guys. And then just it just died one day. And to this day, I really don't know what happened, who didn't like it or what happened. And they just like they let go of him and kept me on as just like Good Hand McGee for a couple more years. And that was it. I don't know. But I mean, in going to FCW, that was 2009. I didn't get fired till 2014, so it bought me a lot more, you know, time.
Yeah, you really lasted longer. And how about you, Matt? Because you never got fired, but you went through the ups and downs. You had, I mean, my goodness, the angle. I still remember that look on your face when you got thrown off the stage by Kane in the wheelchair.
Yeah.
I mean, that, dude, we don't have to dwell on this, but just tell me, that was just insane. There's no pads there. I mean, what the hell? I thought you broke both your ankles when you took that bump.
So, I mean, one of the most heartbreaking things in my career and also in my life was seeing all the hard work. And from Z Trolling Out Story, literally every week it was getting erased. Like, I felt like someone had a giant pencil eraser and erasing a part of my body. Like, that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And one of my biggest regrets is that I was too young and afraid to almost not stand up for myself, but question, like, hey, why is this happening? Like, why? I should have went right to Vince and said, like, hey, I'm selling this merch. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. Why is this happening? And I just took it like, oh, I was just, okay, well, Kane's throwing me off a stage. I guess I'll fight him next week at Backlash or something. And then, you know, like that never happened.
Yeah, nothing.
And then eventually, you know, it all goes away. But I was just so naive and young that I just thought like, okay, well, this is just part of it. You know, Kane, you know, beats me up for a while and all right, well, maybe I'll wrestle him at Backlash or Judgment Day or whatever, you know, like, I just thought that's what would happen, and then, you know, it didn't.
But you always keep getting thrown bones, though, every once in a while. The one I remember is when I think it was my last WrestleMania, I think, with the Money in the Bank, where just out of nowhere, suddenly you win. No, the Intercontinental Championship, yeah, you win.
Right, so, yeah, that was WrestleMania 32, and yes, like, out of the blue, I was just telling Brian about this. I think I was wrestling Cody, actually, on, like, Main Event or Superstars, you know, one of those matches they tape before Raw. Because I never gave up trying, you know? Like, yes, the YouTube show, it ended. But I didn't, like, quit on myself. If anything, I was trying harder. But, you know, either going to get noticed or you're not. Like, you can't control when someone's going to notice you. You know what I'm saying? Like, I use the hashtag always ready, but that's what I believe. You always have to be ready just in case.
And that's true.
Right. And just one day, Vince just happened to be watching the monitor backstage, watching that Superstars or Main Event match. And the story goes like, why aren't we doing something with this guy? Well, I don't know. But a couple of weeks later, I'm in this ladder match for the Intercontinental title, which I was like, holy shit, I'm in this match. And then I win? Like, oh my God. Like, up to that point, I had never heard my music play at WrestleMania. I was in one WrestleMania match and I came out to Teddy Long's music. And I have a Teddy Long t-shirt on because it's like Team Teddy versus Team Johnny.
And you got kicked in the balls.
I got kicked in the balls. That's right.
I remember a time when, I don't remember the year, but I remember we were talking about something. I said, you need to go in the office and tell, I think it was Triple H. And was I right about this? And tell him like, either we need to do something or just let me go.
Right, right. Yeah, so that was like in the middle, I would say in the middle of the YouTube thing dying and this where I had said like, hey, like, what are we doing here? I want to do something. I want to contribute. I know that I can. And that's when it was a little after that they had sent me to NXT to team with Mojo as the Hype Bros, which I was like, you know what? If you're going to give me a chance, I'm going to make the best of it. And at that same time, I was doing the NXT. It's so weird because I was doing the Hype Bros and NXT while I was winning the WWE title at WrestleMania. It was such a bizarre thing. Like, I was doing NXT, WWE, NXT, WWE. And I'm like, well, are we doing this Hype Bros thing? Because I just won the Intercontinental title. Like, what are we doing? I was literally just doing whatever they told me to do and make the best out of any situation I was given.
Brian, let's talk about when you mentioned that you had gotten released or whatever it was in 2014. You went and started, I mean, you worked on the indies and stuff, but you started a wrestling school at that point in time, right?
Yeah, so luckily, I had opened my wrestling school about 2 months before getting fired. So, and I was kind of begging to go. I felt so like, the same as Matt, our careers have been just roller coaster rides of ups and downs, which is cool. That's life, you know? And like you said, we've never like phoned it in, you know, we've always tried to look our best, have cool gear, have good attitude, you know, give 110% in the ring. So, but I was looking I was hoping to get fired. Like, Carano called me, and I was like, oh, thank God.
Thank you.
I thought you were going to tell me to go to NXT and do something. Or I was like, okay, sweet. So I got fired on a Thursday. I wrestled Friday, Saturday, and then just literally for 2 years straight all over. But luckily, I'd opened my school, which was a whole nother level of just almost like therapeutic sense for me to give back. And then it's like enjoying the business through like a whole new set of eyes where I can, like, you know, train these kids and watch them grow from, you know, people I barely know, dumb little kids that will come in here, into like pretty damn polished, good wrestlers that I'm proud of. So that whole thing has just been incredible. It's something I wanted to do. I just thought it would come much later in my career, but, you know, it was a blessing in disguise.
But you have, and I could be, and you might have to remind me, but you've had some students, like we have, I know Chris Statlander trained with you, and she's very, very green, but also very, very good. Like, you can tell she was trained well. She wrestles much higher than her experience level, I think.
Absolutely.
She came out of your school. Who else came from your school?
Well, MJF would have to be the most notable, but I hate to give him such a big plug here on your show, but yeah.
That's another one, right? He told me that. So that's two, I mean, MJF, once again, his personality is way more experienced than his age. So that's two legit top talents that came from your school. That must be pretty gratifying for you as a teacher to know that you gave them enough tools that they're able to get on national TV and fit right in so quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've had a first-class education in the business. I mean, I learned from Mikey Whipwreck straight to the WWE, you know, producers / agents, whatever, for years and years and years and years, you know. So I soaked that all in, and I just want to give it back. So if you put in the work and the dedication to, you know, to come, you're going to get it, you know. So, and Kristen and Max are two of my favorites ever. Kristen is my favorite student ever. She's a super special person, individual, and an exceptional talent. And she's just getting started. She's going to be great. But
I'm glad when she landed on Earth that she found your school.
Yeah. That was one of those things. I was like, you sure about this alien thing? Like, you're pretty talented as is. I don't think you really need this alien thing. But
she's committed to it, man. And that's all you got to be. So let's talk about this final run that you guys had again with Ryder and Hawkins. So you are off for how long was it before you got hired back, Brian?
Oh yeah, it was like exactly 2 years.
And then what led to you coming back?
I believe with that new the SmackDown was going live, and they had just made one of those big cuts like they just made last week.
Right.
And I think they kind of went like, oh shit, we just fired all these guys, but we need guys now for this and that. And what I was told is that Vince wanted guys back that didn't need to be taught, you know, guys that just knew how to work television, and there wasn't much. So they made like a small list, and he handpicked a couple of us off of it. And it was like me and Jinder and Rhino and Shelton.
Shelton.
And that's how it all happened. And then I don't want to say I was misled, but like I was like, oh, cool, this is going to be, you know, sweet, you know, and I had vignettes and stuff, but they really just wanted me back kind of in my old spot of just, you know, making other people look good, which is fine. That's pro wrestling. It is what it is, and I love it either way. You know, I was grateful for it. And then what really happened was some, like, I think some dirt sheet reporter or something wrote some article like Kurt Hawkins loses 100th consecutive match in a row. And it was like getting tweeted to me and shit like that. And I was like, I was sitting there going, well, that's definitely true, you know? And I was like, but I was like, that's awesome. Like, who cares? Let's keep it going. So then I remember, like, I was pitching to everybody, like, let me just keep losing. Like, I'm losing anyway. Like, just make sure I keep losing.
Make it a thing.
Yeah. I was supposed to beat Heath on, like, Superstars or Main Event or whatever. And that was finally when I went to, like, a writer. I made him go to Vince. Like, can you tell him I'd rather not? Like, it was, like, it was in Barclays, and he said something to me, like, let Hawkins get one in his hometown. And I was like, I'd rather not. Let's see, like, where this goes. And I just knew that kind of organically, if I committed to it, something would come of it. And it finally, like, I didn't realize how much I was going to lose. But it finally did pick up steam, where I truly felt like people were invested in my matches like they had never been before. Like, you know, whether I was in Long Island or I was in, like, Paducah, you know, people knew I was the guy that was losing all the time, and they wanted to be there to see me actually win, you know? So people were, like, getting in. It felt good. And at the same time, we kind of started the podcast. And I think that reminded everyone what good friends we were and that we used to be a team.
And then that led to Zach kind of being your motivator to, come on, you got to win type thing, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, in classic Zack Ryder fashion, which, listen, I At the time I used the hashtag still here. Now it's not there. But like, you know, I'm so grateful for the time there, the learning experience, the ups and the downs. Like, listen, I've had the highest of highs, the lowest of lows. And during that time, you know, Hawkins, you think it's bad losing every match? I didn't have a match on Raw in a year. Mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. So I was like,
literally coming every week to TV, but not doing anything. Like, not.
Like, I dress up in, like, my suit, like, try to talk to Vince. One day, I even had, like, it's a funny story. I went to it 1 week, and he's like, great ideas. Next week, bring it to me in writing, right? So the next week, I typed it up like it was a school project. I had the cover sheet and everything. I'm walking around the locker room, and people are making fun of me, taking the picture of Zack Ryder pitches, you know? But I was doing, at that point, I was doing whatever I could. And I knew, like, listen, I've been up and down. Like, I was just hoping, I was being hopeful that something would come around. And luckily, it was just this perfect storm. Hawkins on this losing streak, me doing nothing. People were like, oh my God, these guys used to be partners. Because I think the podcast, the Major Wrestling Favorite Podcast, I'm going to plug it right there. But I think it got it in people's heads. So when I, you know, did the big run in to save Hawkins, it all made sense. And it was the perfect timing.
Did you get your big win, Brian?
Yeah, at WrestleMania, we won the tag team titles in front of our hometown, friends and family, my wife, my kid. It's got to be my favorite.
That's great. Thing I've ever done where was that at? Where was that?
MetLife.
Wow, that's great. A couple years ago, I can't remember, man. Sorry.
It was last year's WrestleMania.
That's great. So that was your big victory, winning the tag team titles at WrestleMania.
269 losses in a row, but I got my WrestleMania moment. I mean, honestly, like, that's what, like, you know, the epitome of, like, people in our business being marks for themselves. Like, I lost 269 matches in a row. I never had more fun. I was never more over. I never made more money, you know, like, business.
You were the reverse Goldberg.
Yeah. No, that's what people called me, actually.
Who did you beat for the titles?
The Revival.
That was super cool for me because, like you said, I had that WrestleMania moment winning the IC title. But this one, I had the front row seat to watch him get his. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm literally on the floor laid out, and the people, they're wanting it to happen. And when he gets that 1, 2, 3, the people go nuts. And it was just so cool that, you know, we start as a team, but we never had like a WrestleMania match. So to come out, especially in our, I say hometown because they were saying New Jersey's New York, but it's New Jersey, but it's the closest thing.
Yeah, it's where the Jets play. It's cool.
Yeah. So for all our friends and family to be there and for it to happen. And then, you know, we won the tag team titles in our hometown. Like, we could write that story. Like, okay, we started in the business together, 18-year-old kids. It takes a while, but we finally get to WrestleMania in our hometown, win the tag team titles. And it's just like, that's life. That's not this. That's not a storyline. You know what I'm saying? To me, it felt as real as it gets.
Well, and once again, like you mentioned, it's a full circle moment. And in the meantime, you also have this podcast, which starts with you guys meeting each other when you're 19, 20 and realizing you have an affinity for wrestling figures. But this has been a couple of years now, and the podcast is very successful. So tell us kind of where the idea came from, obviously, but how are you getting it to be so successful? And what's the theme of it?
Well, see, me and him, we talk about wrestling figures all the time. And I knew I wanted to do some sort of podcast about wrestling figures. And it really, I think, took a while for Brian to agree. And at first, we didn't realize, like, okay, well, what are we going to talk about? The first one is like just 45 minutes of rambling. And then, you know, we start adding segments, and then we start getting our own catchphrases, and then we should make some merch, and we're plugging merch, and then we do live shows, and it's just another snowball, something that I didn't think would get as big as it did so fast.
Do you have guests on it, or like how do you run the show?
We have guests, like, when appropriate, you know, like, we're going to interview you in a little bit, to be honest.
Absolutely, yeah.
But not like weekly, you know, we do it where it fits and where we can have fun with it, or it's easy for us. I think what the root of it is kind of like what we've been saying all along, is that collecting wasn't always like so cool or something you were so quick to like openly talk about. And we have, to a ridiculous level, bared our souls in this show from time and time again, talking about, you know, when we played with our figures and what we did with that Chris Jericho figure and what kind of push he got and, you know, the storyline. And like, it's. So, like, you know, we're completely exposed as nerds, and then our fans are the same, you know, and they see themselves in us, you know, and they realize, oh, these guys are just like me, you know, this is fine, and we've really made a community out of it, and it's been a lot of fun. And Broski's right. At first, I was like, I don't know, man, like, I don't know what could this really be, you know, a podcast about wrestling figures, but it's gone above and beyond my wildest dreams.
So how how is there, sorry to interrupt you, dude, but how is there so much material to talk about? Like, how many wrestling figures are there that you could do this every week?
We literally have to stop ourselves. There's so much to talk about.
Like, that's the thing. Like, sometimes he's like, all right, let's wrap it up. Let's cut a segment, collapsible seg, because we can just keep going. Yeah. You know, and like, we just did, we've done a couple live shows, and the last one we just did, we actually had to do via Skype. And we had a lot of people, you know, phone in, but it's a 2-hour show. Maybe 10 minutes of it is actually about toys. It's turned into this whole like community and like inside jokes. And like, it's just like you watch 40-Year-Old Virgin, which came out like 10, 15 years ago. And the guy is literally a virgin. He's a loser and he has these figures on display. But now we're trying to advocate, like, you know, it's cool to collect. Everyone collects something, you know?
I truly think, like, if that movie came out now, they wouldn't be able to depict that guy as such a loser. If he had a collection like that, people are like, whoa, this is pretty valuable, sweet stuff this guy's got, you know?
But that's the thing. When you find the community, like for me, like, I'm a big Kiss fan. There's so many Kiss podcasts. Like, literally, there's 20 of them. How much stuff does Kiss have that you can talk about it on 20 separate podcasts? Yeah, but it's right. Not just the material. It's the different guys on each show. It's the camaraderie. It's the fun element of it. And I think that's kind of what you guys have discovered, that whether you talk about, you know, wrestling figures or whatever it may be, it's everybody that's tuning in to hear you guys talk about whatever it is that you're talking about that week. And that's where the beauty of the show comes from.
Right. It's the back and forth banter. Right? It's the ripping on each other, making fun of each other. It's just like two guys being friends. It's really, we're talking about wrestling. It's really just nostalgic, right? You can't go back in time. You can't get in the DeLorean and go back to 1985 when, you know, it was Christmas morning and you opened that LJ and Hulk Hogan. But through this podcast, you kind of can a little bit. You know, you know what? Maybe let me go on eBay and get that Jimmy Snuka figure from 86 that you know, my mom never got me. And then you get it. Like, holy shit, this is cool. Maybe I'll get the Corporal Kirshner. I'll get the JYD. And then you're like, oh my God, I'm a 35-year-old man buying all these toys. It's like you're recreating the memories from childhood and creating ones that you never got to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've had some unreal, like, sentimental messages from our listeners or people like, you know, I lost my father this past year, and I remember he bought me this, you know, Hulk Hogan Hasbro, and I got it off eBay, and, you know, you guys inspired me, and things like that, like, are just pretty surreal. It's a very, you know, everyone has very sentimental feelings about their childhood, and sometimes it's linked to things like the toys you had.
Sure it is. And it's cool right now, especially in this time, you know, with the pandemic going on, with the technology we have, like us being able to talk right now, looking at each other, sound quality's great. And it's providing great content, not just for us, to give us something to do, but people that are stuck at home, excited every week. What are they going to talk about this week? What's going to be on Talk is Jericho? What's going to be on the Figure show? I mean, that's where the community also extends as well.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, like I said, we just did this, like, say, live, but it was this 2-hour event that we put on YouTube, and like all the fans tuned in, and it was just, it wasn't about figures. They're tuning in to see what we're going to say, what we're going to do. We have storylines on our show. You know, we have this fake wrestler named Stang, and he went to Heath Slater's house and beat him up with the bat. Like, it has nothing to do with wrestling figures, you know? But it was on the show. People loved it.
Chris, can I just tell you where that came from?
Sure.
We had Slater on the show, and we said, hey, man, like, you like wrestling growing up? Who was your favorite? He's like, man, I just love Stang growing up, man. I'm like, Stang with an A?
Oh, that's great. There was a guy called Hardbody Harrison, at WCW Jobber, and used to pitch all these ideas to DDP, and one of his ideas was that he was going to be the Black Sting and call himself Stang.
S-T-A-N-G. Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whoa.
They didn't use it, but that's it. So.
That's a good one.
Last few questions for you guys. Now that you guys are free agents, obviously it's not the same as it would be. Like you mentioned, Brian, when you got released last time on a Thursday and you're working on a Friday, now there's no shows to go to because of the situation that we're in, but it gives you a little bit of time to kind of think about what you want to do. Any thoughts about the future? You guys want to try and do a tag team, singles, both?
Well, we've collectively already decided that we're only going to take tag team bookings if the juice is worth the squeeze. You know what I mean? It's got to be, you know.
Where's the headbangers, you know?
Headbangers. Give us Rock and Roll Express. You know, it's got to be something like that. We're not coming to wrestle Billy and Bobby, the local hometown heroes. No offense.
Gotcha.
Honestly, I have not decided. I think there's wrestling has never been more plentiful. Like in the career that we've had, you know, the 16 years we've been doing this, there's so many options and so many cool things that could be done. So I'm just excited to do it. I just wish I could do it right now. That's the hardest part. Mm-hmm. It's just waiting, you know. Tom Petty said it best. You know, the waiting is the hardest part. And because last time, you know, in less than 24 hours, I got out of my system. I had wads of cash on me. I was like, oh my God, this is cool shit, you know.
Right.
And
right.
I'm about to do, you know, forward rolls in my backyard here because I'm so itchy to just get out there. But that's really it. I just want to go because I think the sky's the limit.
How about you, Matt?
Yeah, it's like, you know, when everyone was getting those phone calls last week, obviously you don't know for sure if it's going to be you, but I'm like, I already have my pro wrestling tee store ready to go. I had my logos made up. I'm like, here we go. Because through this podcast and even through the YouTube, I love like just being creative and seeing like those results and hustling, you know? So I cannot, I feel like I'm Christmas morning. I see those presents. And I just want to run and open them all up. So like Brian said, the fact that we can't wrestle right now. Okay. But I'm just so pumped. I'm just so like just anxious to get out there and be creative. And there's things I've never done. And there's things I want to do, like, you know, Rapid Delivery Rory Fox. I'll say it right here on Talk is Jericho. I want to wrestle Rapid Delivery Rory Fox in a tuxedo match. You know?
Oh my God. What a bizarre dream match, right?
Still one of the best stories ever. We don't have to get into it, but basically right. Rory, Rapid Delivery's tights basically exploded during a match with Zach. And he was
Chris,
not
he's
wearing
a reoccurring guest on our show. So.
He was not wearing undertight. So he made a career out of that, man. That's what right. you got to do, right?
Exactly.
See, but what I was going to say too, though, both you guys, I'm glad you got to discover this. By having your own podcast, your personality, your excitement, your passion, you know, WWE is a great company, but if you only work there, you forget what it's like to truly be creative and truly be in charge of what you want to do. And that's what the essence of pro wrestling is. So I think it's great that you guys, I've been saying this to you for years, Matt, it's time to go and see what's going on outside of the WWE system. And I'm excited for you guys because I can tell that you still have this excitement even more so now to realize we're free to do whatever the hell we want.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, I don't want to say this wrong because it's unfortunate that so many people lost their jobs last week, right? That is sad. But on a flip side, like with my school, Creative Pro Wrestling, I have to run shows because I can't just say, hey, book all 9 of my students. You know, it's not how wrestling works. So I had to kind of default become a promoter. And there's almost like there's nobody to bring in to put on a poster or anything because there's so many, and it's awesome, there's so many thriving wrestling companies on television that I was having a hard time doing that. And now that you've like unleashed kind of, you know, 20-something pissed off wrestlers ready to prove a point out there, like that's fun, man. That's like that creative energy and excitement is like infectious. And I think like wrestling as a whole will eventually thrive because of it.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
Yeah. And like my main thing is, listen, like I was there for so long, right? And I am grateful for everything, the ups and the bads, because the ups and the downs, I truly believe that is why I'm the person I am today. Not just, I grew up as a man there and as a wrestler.
Yeah.
More importantly, as a man and a person, you know? But right now, like, I don't really care about proving people wrong. I want to prove everyone right. All those supporters, everyone who really gave a shit about me during that YouTube era or every little time when they didn't have to care about me. That's who I want to prove right. And I want to prove myself right. And I just cannot wait for all the opportunities out there.
Last question for you guys. What's your favorite match that you had within your WWE careers?
Mine has to be last year's WrestleMania. Like I said, hometown. You know, I got a kiss from my wife and daughter holding the tag team titles, you know, on screen, you know, front row. Won the tag team titles with my best friend, the guy I started the business with, 18 years old. You know, and especially in the WWE world where in your hometown you usually get put in a dumpster or something. You know, so to have such a cool moment, that's irreplaceable to me. You know, sentimental-wise. I've had matches that were fun and great and all, but sentimental-wise, I don't think anything's going to top that for a long time.
Right. Yeah, and I'd be lying if I didn't say it was when I won the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania. I mean, for so many reasons, it was just the ups and downs. I keep saying ups and downs, but I had a lot of them, you know? But to finally get that moment, I was like, you know what? Like, it was all worth it for this. And then to look down and see my dad, who legitimately, Ziggler said, come on over. And he said, okay. I just hopped the barricade. Like, that was not part of the show. You know, my dad gets in the ring, and then he's wearing the Dallas WrestleMania cowboy hat, tries to put it on my head. And at the time, I'm so pissed, I yank it off, you know? But, you know, that Rob Schamberger, he painted a nice photo of us hugging, and you of course, you see the hat in it, and you see the IC title. And when I got the call knowing that I was getting released, like when I got it, like I was looking right at that picture, and I was smiling, like, you know what, this is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I did that, I had that moment, like my dad got to see that. And now it's all about creating new moments, new memories, and I'm just so excited.
Well, guys, once again, congratulations on a great run in the company. It's not easy to do to stay on the main roster for as long as you guys did, and I'm excited to see what happens in the future, and I'm excited to talk about some wrestling action figures on your show. So
thank you very much.
We'll say goodbye, and then we'll say hello in a few minutes.
You got it. Thanks, Chris.
All right, thanks, guys. Chris.
I'm looking forward to seeing you guys out there soon.